The British government, which owns National Westminster Bank, a bank it bailed out for billions of pounds, that's even more in billions of dollars, now wants to sell it back to the public. And if you're confused, you're not alone. I am too. Welcome to Constable Confidential. I'm Simon Constable. Joining us now is eminent journalist Ian Fraser. He's also the author of Shredded, Inside RBS, Royal Bank of Scotland, the bank that broke Britain. Now, if you're confused, that's because NatWest was what was RBS, Royal Bank of Scotland, and they changed the name. It doesn't mean the malfeasance that happened there is gone. It just means the name has changed. Ian's going to explain this complicated stuff to us. Thank you for joining us, Ian.
Hi, Simon. Yeah, great to join you.
Let us learn from you what's going on here. My understanding is that taxpayers in Britain rescued what is now NatWest for billions and billions of pounds. And now the government is planning on selling it back to us for even more billions of our pounds that we have in our pocket. I thought we paid for it once. What's going on?
Okay, well, Gordon Brown and Alistair Darling, who were then the Prime Minister and Chancellor in October 2008, decided that because RBS was collapsing for a variety of reasons, which I won't necessarily go into, they had to rescue it. Otherwise, there'd be blood on the streets and anarchy in the UK to lift the Sex Pistols song title. And they therefore lavished an initial £1.3 trillion sterling to save...
Which, by the way, is more than one-third of the size of the British economy now. Just to give you an idea of how big that is, that's a huge amount. And Britain is a relatively rich country. Obviously, it's not as rich as America, but £1.3 trillion. The UK economy is about $3 trillion. So that's, you know, well in excess of a third. That's a staggering amount.
That was an initial outlay when much of that was returned. Was eventually returned to, you know, in various different ways to the government and to the Bank of England. But what happened was that they, as part of that rescue package, they put in £45.5 billion into buying preference shares.
Just to explain to everyone, a preference share is really a loan that might be a little more risky than a regular loan. I think I'm right in saying that.
Yes, I think that's broadly correct. And although it's unclear because they must have also bought ordinary shares, but in the end, the injection into, you know, direct capital injection, which was made by taxpayers, was £45.5 billion. And that was in a series of rolling bailouts that occurred between October 08 and November 2009 in their desperate attempt to stabilize this institution. So now they therefore ended up owning 83% of the equity in the Royal Bank of Scotland Group PLC, which was renamed to
National Westminster Bank, which was bank.
It's complicated because they actually acquired a bigger bank back in 2000, the Scottish Bank, Royal Bank of Scotland, which is a very old bank dating back to 1727. Had been, you know, reasonably successful and did acquire a much larger English bank in 2000 called National Westminster Bank, or NatWest. But instead of taking its name at that stage, they continued to call the group RBS Group PLC. And NatWest was just an operating subsidiary, which was their retail brand in the UK market. But then, because their own brand became so badly tainted, a woman called Alison Rose, who was chief executive until quite recently, she decided to, in a bid to kind of, in a sort of acceptance that they failed to turn Royal Bank of Scotland and its reputation around, chose to use the English bank's name as the group name. So they renamed the group NatWest Group PLC in July 2020. But now what's happening? There was another rolling series of institutional share offers where institutional investors were allowed to buy shares, given the opportunity to buy shares in what was RBS and what became NatWest, in over various stages, I think starting in 2015, and they were dribbling them out so as not to put too many shares into the market at once, which they feared would make the share price fall. So they dribbled out shares to institutions in various stages between 2015 and today. And the latest ploy is to emulate something which happened in the late 80s, which was called the Tell Sid campaign, when the UK government of Mrs. Thatcher privatized many of the state-owned companies or state-owned businesses, including British Gas, which is now called Centrica. And it was done in a very sort of populist way, trying to persuade the ordinary man in the street that, you know, it would be in their interest to buy shares in a privatization. And these were all done by a PR firm called Dew Rogerson. And obviously a lot of investment banks made a lot of money out of these reprivatizations or these privatizations that occurred in the late 80s and early 90s.
I should explain to folks that after World War II was over, a lot of companies that were large were made public. They became wards of the state, if you like. Yes. Under the Labour government and generally more left-leaning governments than we have now. Now, that was an ideological decision based on the leaning of the ruling parties. But this case with NatWest, it could have been let to go bankrupt. And I know there were lots of scaremongering, but I think the scaremongering was coming from bankers. So they're saying, if you don't bail us out, then there'll be blood in the streets. Maybe. Well, maybe not too. Why don't we try it and find out?
Yeah. Well, the US tried it with Lehman Brothers, and it didn't create blood in the streets, but it did precipitate a wider crisis. But yeah, in any case, we were obviously given no choice in October 08 as taxpayers. It was done without our consent, without consulting us, or without even a debate in Parliament. It was just seen by the Labour government of that time that's the right thing to do, that we had to rescue this bank. And there were other ones involved too, like HBOS and Lloyds, which were also rescued in a similar sort of way. But yeah, now we're being, as you say, being offered the chance to buy a bank that we technically already own. Although, yeah, it's complicated again, because I think the share owned by the taxpayer has reduced to around about 36%. I should have checked that. But it has fallen from 83, which was the maximum percentage that the taxpayers owned in this troubled banking group, down to roughly around 35-36% today. So already, more than 65% is owned by institutional investors again. So it's a muddy picture.
It's a very muddy picture, and yeah. I think if this was a private individual trying to do this, I'm going to rescue this company with your money, Ian. I'm going to use your money to rescue this bank and then sell it back to you when it's been rescued, which is still a bizarre thing to me. And maybe it's got some logic, but try it as a private individual, and I'm sure you'll be going to jail for a while. I want to move on to something else, which is very, very interesting to me, is that recently there was another scandal at NatWest, with the CEO being pushed out of the job of CEO because she was involved in stopping a prominent politician having a bank account at NatWest. That was a bit of a scandal. So is there a culture of horribleness, of vice or something going on inside NatWest that has survived through the crisis, through the next 10 years, through the name change and everything? What are your thoughts on that? You know more about NatWest Group than anyone I know, and probably anyone on the world.
Well, the toxic culture which prevailed under Fred Goodwin, who was the chief executive that led it to its collapse, has sadly prevailed. You know, there are lots and lots of signs of this in terms of just minor things like complaints handling, the way that SMEs were treated by the bank
That's
in the aftermath.
Small and medium-sized enterprises. So
yes,
the lifeblood of the British economy.
Yes, the way that thousands and thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of small and medium-sized enterprises were maltreated, mistreated, abused, ransacked, and in some cases pillaged, and in some cases destroyed by RBS NatWest in the aftermath of the crisis, which mainly happened under a man called Stephen Hester between 2009 and 2014, is indicative of seriously sick culture inside that institution. And things that happened after that, including their attempts to suppress independent reports into their own behavior, suggest that the bank, it has not I say under Fred Goodwin the bank lost its moral compass, but under the successive chief executives who've taken over since he was kicked out in October 08, they haven't even bothered to find it again, if there ever was one. So I think it's an ongoing, enduring problem inside the bank, and it probably happens, at other banks too. But RBS just seems to be a particularly bad example.
It does seem to be a particularly bad example. It keeps getting PR, that public relations, black eyes by the plenty. And you have worked as a professional journalist at the Glasgow Herald, and I've worked as a professional journalist at many places, and it's like shooting fish in a barrel as a journalist to say, oh my God, I can't believe they've actually done that, because it makes it so easy to write a story about it when the facts actually come out. One thing that is worrying me, and it's about all the banks in the UK, and this is also somewhat true in America, is that the banks are critical for the growth of the housing market in the UK, and the housing market is short many millions of houses for all the people that need houses to live in, houses or apartments, flats, whatever you want to call them, places to dwell that are warm in the winter, cool in the summer, and dry at all times, and not dangerous. But the lending hasn't really kept up with that. Do you blame the banks in general for that, or is that something else going on here with this shortage of housing everywhere?
I mean, I think that mortgages, they are still available. I don't think it's necessarily the primary cause. It's lack of credit. I think it's more strategic. It's to do with policy. It's to do with land, the taxation of land. There are so many different movable parts in the problem of how to resolve the UK's housing crisis. But I had one little vignette on that, which is in the US in 2007, Nouriel Roubini and other economists were warning that the US housing market had got completely out of kilter. There was inevitably going to be a massive crash, housing market crash in the US. And they were warning from 06 onwards. And this was partly because the average house, the median house, was four times the median salary. And that I think is quite interesting, because now in the UK, in London, the median house price is 11 times the median salary. And I think in the rest of the UK, it's between six and nine times. So, what they saw as a mega threat to the future of the housing market in the US back in 07 is actually, we've gone way beyond that.
We have gone way beyond that, but we also know that there are cheaper ways to build houses now, and that we do know that no matter what houses are built, if there are a lot more of them, then prices will moderate at a very minimum. And if we have a heck of a lot more of them, then prices will come down, because it's a market of units. So I'm really puzzled as to why people in Britain aren't building upwards, as they do in New York. Upwards is good. You can go to, you don't need more land. You just need, to head towards the sky, and that, add a few more stories on a building. I realize not everyone wants to live in a flat or an apartment, but they can be very nice places to live. There's certainly a lot less work to deal with than a house with a garden, especially with a big garden. That can be a lot of work for people.
Yes.
I'm really unsure about this, and I think it's a big problem, and it seems that the government refuses, the current government, the previous government, the government before that, basically refuses to push local councils to say, okay, time to build, and we don't care about your petty, you know, it doesn't fit idea. We have people who are homeless, who can't afford a home, who are good, honest, working people. Why shouldn't they have a place to live?
Well, even my children, you know, I have three children, they're all in their 20s now. And, you know, the chances of them owning a house at the age I bought my first house and are nil. I mean, I was actually 30 or something when I bought my first flat in London. But with the current house prices and, you know, their salaries, I just don't think there's any chance they're going to be able to do that. So it's a real problem for society. And it's something which needs to be urgently addressed. And I don't think any government, let alone any devolved government or central government in the UK, seems to have any, you know, sensible plans. To some extent, I think too many governments are in hock to the existing house builders, who are pretty unimaginative in what they want to do, which is basically build lots of quite small houses, but all semi-detached or detached, which is no, you know, that's not the way to do it.
I would certainly say that is not the way to do it. I know that verged away from what's going on in NatWest and everywhere else. Now, you live in Scotland. How is the economy there for you right now? We've got about three minutes to go. My understanding it's faltering a little bit like the rest of the UK. What are your thoughts based on your anecdotal observations?
I mean, personally, I don't feel it's that bad. I did see that the latest GDP statistics for the fourth quarter in Scotland were down 0.6, which was quite a, you know, significant fall for a single quarter. That barely got reported, by the way, which I think is an indictment of the Scottish media that, you know, if that had happened in London, it would have been covered everywhere. But here, it only got picked up by about two or three papers. Yeah, I mean, it's certainly not great, and it's but it's it, people. As far as I'm concerned, as personally, I'm coping all right. You know, as a journalist and with various other jobs that I do, I managed to keep my head above water. But I'm lucky in that, you know, I did get onto the housing ladder in 1990, in the early 90s, and I kind of rode the house price bubble. So it's enabled me to live in reasonably good quality housing without having to pay a massive mortgage. So yeah, I've been incredibly lucky in that regard. But oh gosh, about the economy, I mean, it's not great, and the councils are struggling. There's cuts being made to a lot of public services. You do see potholes in the road, in certain roads. You see some rail services being reduced.
And hang on, the potholes are in the capital city of Scotland. This is and in the centre of the capital city of Scotland, which is meant to be the crown jewel of the entire country. Am I wrong by saying that?
Well, the worst. I mean, I live outside Edinburgh, and the worst ones I see are actually in some of the rural roads, the kind of less used rural roads. There are some in Edinburgh too. I mean, Edinburgh, I suppose, has got some interesting things going on in it. Like, it's got this new shopping mall at the east end of Princes Street called the St. James's Quarter. That seems to be doing all right. But I think that's had the knock-on effect of actually making a lot of premises on the main shopping street, which is called Princes Street, become empty. And actually, that is a really bad sign, I think. Walking along what should be the premier shopping street in Scotland, Princes Street, which, by the way, only has one side of shops, because the other side is a garden. And you see probably at least 20% of the shops are vacant, and you see homeless people living, camping outside the hoardings of the boarded up shops. So that is, if there is one sign that worries me about Scotland's economy at the moment, it's probably that.
To explain to people who aren't familiar with Edinburgh and Princes Street, that's the equivalent of Oxford Street in London, which is a big retail shopping street with both sides of the road with a lot of shops, or Fifth Avenue in New York, where there are a lot of shops to go buy clothing and other things there. So this is a big deal. I would recommend anyone with any interest about what's going on in the UK economy, look at Ian's fantastic book, Ian Fraser's book, Shredded: Inside RBS, the Bank That Broke Britain. And remember the fact that the company has now changed its name to NatWest, just to, well, maybe to confuse people. Who knows? I don't know what's inside other people's heads. It certainly confused me changing there. Thank you very much, Ian Fraser, journalist extraordinaire. This is Constable Confidential. I'm Simon Constable, and that's it.